Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery, with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
I had a hell of a time getting back from Kelowna, British Columbia. My God, man, it was a travel from hell, going and coming.
What was the total delay? Was it like more than 24 hours or?
Probably 3 days more of traveling than I had to have, or at least two. But the workshop went really well. I mean, people are very excited about emotional sobriety.
Before we start, I just want to say, Alan, I thought of you this weekend. Your favorite guy, Jelly Roll, I saw him at the Stagecoach Music Festival. And I the song that you like that he does, it's I'm not okay, but everything's gonna be all right, right? That's the emotional sobriety song for you. Yeah. So anyway.
Did he sing it?
He sung it, yeah. And he talked about addiction for a little bit. And he does a song about losing somebody to like a opiate overdose. And I guess he said he went to Congress to talk about the fentanyl crisis recently. And I would have liked to be a fly on the wall for, you know, what happened with all that. Anyway, so the discussion today, I would love to hear from Julie as much as possible about how the workshops have been. And I don't know, what do we think? Any themes? Anything come up for you guys recently?
Honestly, I don't know how cogent I can be at 7 a.m. This is 15 minutes before I normally get up. So I will do my very best. But one thing I've been thinking about is I went to a yoga retreat this weekend. And, you know, for me, yoga helps me sort of create some of the ways of being that allow me to have emotional sobriety. And what I mean by that is, you know, beyond just the movements and the poses, it teaches, you know, being present, self-acceptance. And this particular workshop, I work with a teacher named Rebecca Snowball, and she's wonderful. Like, she's really goofy and open-minded. And there was a lot of laughter. And one of the things that she talked about in yoga was that you have to sort of pull in your muscles, you know, tighten everything, and then you can stretch out. And I feel like there's something to that in emotional sobriety also, you know, like that going inward and finding our stability and sort of finding the positions until we can reach and shine out to others. But then it, you know, emotional sobriety is also very much about relationships for me, how I interact with other people, even how I treat myself.
Maybe first we can talk about, you know, what led you to, you know, this space, and how did you get started like on this recovery journey?
I'm really grateful to be here. First of all, I've been listening to the podcast for a while, and I found the workshop through the podcast because you guys had talked about it. And then there's the Zoom link at the bottom. And for the longest time, it was in my calendar, but it took a while for me to make the time to come. And since I found it, I think I've come pretty much every week. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into the rooms in 2017. I won't talk too much about that. But like many of us, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. My world had gotten very small, you know, where, you know, my idea of a good time was being alone by myself with a bottle in a dark room. And I still had friends, I had a car, I had a good job, I had a lot of people that loved me, and I still loved them. But it was just, you know, that little voice inside was getting louder and louder, like, this isn't, you can't do this anymore. And it took me a while. My sobriety date is in 2019, you know, and it wasn't my first one. But that was the time I got very, very serious about recovery, because I knew something really, really bad was going to happen eventually if I kept going the way I was going. Yeah. And for me, my bottom was when my mother, who was still alive at the time and was trying so hard to help me and was my best friend, you know, looked at me and said, you know, I had told her I was going to run away from her to go find a drink because I had to have a drink. And she said, that's not my daughter talking. That's the disease. And that was just like, whoosh.
Yeah, I was just going to say, my mom got me started on all this as well. And Alan did. And, you know, I was, he introduced me to, you know, some of these ideas kind of very early in my sobriety. I did 30 days of rehab, which was really essential. And that's when I got locked in to the practice of going to AA meetings and, you know, and building those social bonds.
Yeah, we get well together. I mean, we get sick alone, I think, and we get well together. And for me, you know, it was right. I got sober right before COVID. And a group of us that had, I also went to rehab, had gotten to be friends, started a Zoom meeting, called Serenity Sunday, which was a women's meeting. And from that, like the second year, a sort of book club called Emotional Sobriety came out of that. And it was because we were reading the Grapevine article, Emotional Sobriety. But that sort of naturally turned into an emotional sobriety meeting where each week one of us would find something that was related to emotional sobriety and talk about it. And it was these same five women, and we still get together every week, actually on Monday nights, and do emotional sobriety. And right now we're working with the ACA program, actually. That sort of opened the door. And one of the women brought the podcast, actually, and said, you know, there are these guys, Tom and Alan and Patrick, and there's this podcast I listen to. And that's how I found you guys.
Well, Taylor, thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here, and the energy you bring is incredible, Julia. Everybody comment on how much they enjoy your participation in Thursday nights. And it's great to connect with you in this way and that you found this stuff so meaningful.
I'm at the point where I don't want to drink anymore. Nice. Actually ever, which I'm grateful for. I know that could change. But emotional sobriety addresses all the other stuff, right? And every day I have, you know, every time I'm disturbed, there's a little bit of hope in that, even because I know I can learn to, it's an opportunity to respond differently. And I don't always do that. In fact, probably 50% of the time I don't, you know, I stay upset for a little while, but there's always an opportunity.
Well, that reminds me, one of my favorite parts of that, of Bill Wilson's letter is that we read every Thursday night, is that the part that says and I'm not quoting it exactly, but whenever we're disturbed, if we look closely enough, we will find unrealistic expectations. And what I'm saying is about that, I mean, I usually, when somebody says something definitively in this business, I cringe and go like, no, nothing's always, you know, it's like, but this is, what are the unrealistic expectations rather than do I have them? And it's, and I think people sometimes have to get over the initially being offended by that. But you know, I mean, hell, we're alcoholics. We get offended by everything.
Well, God, like the emotional sobriety stuff was such a help. And I'd love to hear more about your story, Julia, but like where it really came in was with my perfectionism, all of the distress that I was medicating from a early age, that came from this feeling of falling short and just like, you know, my inflexibility around disappointments in life, you know, really like in adolescence is, you know, when I started smoking weed. Once I got just a little bit of sobriety, I realized now we got to work on all the things that led me to the drugs in the first place. And that's where I think, you know, these ideas really come into play.
I got introduced to a concept from the Inuit people when I was up in Canada, and they create what they call an Inukshuk, which is a stone monument. The monument is erected in the image of humans. One of its purposes was to serve as direction markers in the harsh and desolate environment of the Arctic. It was a tool of survival and a symbol of unselfish acts of the Inuit people. The Inuksuk symbolizes cooperation, balance, and unselfishness. The idea that teaching and group effect is greater than individual effort. Each stone, you see it, how it's put together? It's a separate entity, yet each supports and is supported by the one above it and the one below it. No one piece is any more or any less important than the other. That goes to your nutshell, Tom.
Right. I was thinking about that. Oh.
Yeah. No one piece in the stone is any less or more important than the other. The strength lies in its unity. Its significance comes from its meaning as a whole. Gestalt, right? Reminds us of our interdependent responsibilities to invest our efforts today to a better way for all of us tomorrow. That's what emotional sobriety is. It's like that marker that we've all stumbled across in the Arctic where we've been lost and we're trying to find our way. So I think it's so, and you know, that just reminded me of your story about finding us and finding this podcast and finding the Thursday night. And now your contribution, you're one of us, you're one of those stone markers out there in the world. And we're all leaving those stone markers everywhere we go. That may be our new symbol, Patrick.
I was also thinking of that Bob Marley lyric, the stone that the builder refused will always be the head cornerstone.
But I don't want to detract from your story, but I just thought that that's so apropos to what you're saying to us this morning about how you found us, Julia. So please, you know, talk a little bit about, well, you know, you shared a little bit about finding emotional sobriety and stuff like that and how it shows up in your relationships. And maybe you could elaborate on that piece a little bit more. How do you find it of value in your relationship?
I mean, like Patrick, I also... you know, found disappointments to be devastating from being a very young child and even later. And that inflexibility, you know, my mother would talk to me a lot about how important flexibility was. And it was like one in one ear, out the other, right? and a lot of the stuff in emotional sobriety, it's like I get it intellectually when we talk about it. And then at some point, you know, some of it integrates through an experience that I have. And I'll give an example of that. I mean, I have a stepdaughter, that I really love. Her name is Audrey. But she's a teenager now. She's 14, and starting to, you know, become a teenager, and in her room more and, you know, pushing boundaries, and when we first met, I was very lucky because she decided immediately that I was cool. And, you know, she thought, you know, she told me that she loved me within 6 months. And I think I'm really unusually lucky that way. And lately, things have been a little bit more difficult. You know, underneath that for me is the fact that I am stepping into this already formed family, right? Larry and the kids are very close. They have... you know, when I showed up, they had their own routines. They had their own, you know, way of being. Like even the house is set up like in a different way. And I was aware of that, right? Like I'm this interloper coming in. And there's this desire to be part of the family, but also a desire not to push my way in. Recently it's been, you know, occasionally more difficult with Audrey. And I have this fear of being left out, you know, of not being loved enough, is underneath that, I think. And so certain little things, you know, she'll say something slightly rude and it's just, she's being a teenager. It's not about me, you know, in my mind, I know it's not about me. But I still feel it, right? It's like, and a lot of the time I have to pause. That's a big thing I've learned in emotional sobriety when I want to either, you know, when I want to attack back, or I want to burst into tears, I need to take a deep breath.
You got to realize that part of us that gets offended is, you know, one version of that child inside of us, or in this case, the teenager. And, you know, you got two teenagers to parent, yeah, instead of one, because you got to help you have the right boundaries with that and remind, yeah, you of the responsibilities. And in the meantime, you got a teenager.
And what I realized the other day, though, that dropping down thing, right? Like we talk about the things we can and cannot change and the things we can and cannot control, is I have this idea that if I'm just the perfect stepmother, you know, if I say and that is possible to say and do exactly the right thing, to be funny and warm all the time and to have boundaries, but also be super cool, that we would have the perfect relationship and there would be no conflict. That's
crazy. Seems right. That seems accurate,
that's,
right, guys?
Is there any problem with that? that's crazy. And I was operating under that assumption and putting all this pressure on myself that every time there was a disturbance, that it's my fault, that I'm doing something wrong, you know? And like, sometimes I make mistakes, but that's because I'm human. And just that gave me so much relief.
It is an incredible challenge to blend a family. First of all, I mean, there are so many challenges that exist in that versus just starting a relationship with someone where you're starting more, you're never starting from a clean slate, but you're starting from zero in terms of the relationship, right? You don't have all these, like you said, you walked into a family that's already operating and you're trying to figure out, how do I fit into this system now and make this work for me? And it sounds like in many ways you've done a remarkable job, but those expectations about, my God, if I do this, if I do that, then it'll just click, right? And then it'll all fall into place. And then we'll have this great blended family. And no, you're right. Those things are a challenge. They come up for us and they get in the way of dealing with what is.
The first question is, how am I contributing? What's my part of this? And it's like, and it's so important for people with lower self-esteem or people who tend to be very self-doubting is to say, to make it clear that if, when you go and find your part, your contribution, that does not mean that the other person doesn't have a contribution. It just means you're doing what you're responsible for doing. And if you're going to, in terms of parenting, my belief is that is you're in much better shape when you're doing that, to be able to guide her, if she's open to it, to finding her part, you know, because for one thing, you become a role model to do that because you're doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in any relationship, it's so important to know that. It's like, how am I contributing is one of the first questions to ask. And it's not, and we have to differentiate that from the old way of saying it, you know, oh, how am I fucking this up? Because that's, most of us have that should monster message in there that says, you know, if something's wrong and somebody's messing something up and I'm here, it's probably me, you know, and it's it may be partially you, but it's not, that's not a useful way of actually trying to solve the problem.
With Audrey, you're noticing, you know, you're learning to not personalize her teenagehood, you know, or whatever she may be going through. And, you know, like, when I wasn't sober and when I had no concept of emotional sobriety, I was undifferentiated, as they say. So everything was just this solid block. And, you know, there was no my part, their part. There was just, you know, cause and effect. And then I felt bad.
Yeah. I mean, the it's my fault and it's happening to me. None of that is real useful, right? The what's my part, and it's just information. Even if it's sometimes slightly painful information, being able to look at that honestly, I think requires a lot of self-love and self-acceptance.
You didn't ask what's right or what's wrong about what I'm thinking. You ask, is this useful? Emotional sobriety to me is extremely practical. It's about energy efficiency, you know, which is simply applying the serenity prayer correctly, so that I'm not wasting energy on things I don't stand a chance to control. But changing the question of what's wrong, or especially what's wrong with me, with what's working, what's not working, is a life changer. It really is. So if people listen, and don't wait around those kind of questions don't change on their own. This is where it's a very behavioral thing you do. You make a note of the kinds of questions you want to be asking in times of distress, write them down and review them on a regular basis and use them, repeatedly. And that's how you form new habits.
Yeah. And I really enjoyed the email that you sent out about, you know, when you're upset, check how you contribute to your own misery. Are you making something more important than it has to be? There was something about, are you offended by reality? And that humor in there. I'm going to print that out actually and put it on the fridge.
That's cool. Yeah. The three of us have been talking about that concept of being offended by reality recently, just realizing that it kind of boils down to that. You know, it's like, what, can you believe this is happening? Yeah.
To me. It's happening to me, right?
Yeah, it happened. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
I find reality very offensive.
Especially the last few months, right?
Hey, listen, reality can also be very entertaining. That's one of my missions on this earth.
Right. That's where Tom comes in.
Telling you guys the horrendous experience I've just had with travel. And I kept reminding myself of that, look, this is the reality of it. I can be upset about it or I can deal with it. And at several points, I had to make that decision. Do I get mad at the person behind this thing, or do I find a way to try to best figure out what to do now, given that I can get angry? It's not going to change the reality. This plane is not leaving. I'm not getting back to where I want to go.
Well, you know, Alan, think about that. This is drastic. It's a drastic change of how we were raised in this culture, to realize that when the shit is hitting the fan and all this stuff is going wrong, it's like, I still have a choice about how I'm going to respond to it. It's like, and I don't know. And basically I have a choice to not respond by being upset, or at least not let me follow that response. That's a reflex response. So I'm going to have that, but I don't need to go with that response. Instead, it's, I remember standing in line when I used to speed a lot. I went to traffic school a whole bunch, and we didn't do things online back in those days. We you know, so you had to stand in line, you know, to get into traffic school and all this other stuff. And man, there were just zillions of people. And I remember, this is one of the great compliments I've gotten in my life. It's like, we were standing there, all a bunch of people in line, and this guy behind me says, I was talking to the guy in front of me. He says, "Are you having fun?" And I go, you know, it's like, and I went, "Yeah, why not?" Have fun. And so we, you know, and so in our little group there, we kind of tended to have a little bit more fun, because people don't think of the fact that we might as well enjoy ourselves while we're here in the line to get into traffic school.
Well, you know, what I was going to say is, I think another part of this thing is that it's a lot easier to not react when it's not personal.
God, yes. See,
I didn't take the flight stuff personally, but in my relationships, like you're talking about, Julia, it becomes a whole bigger challenge. I can't find that pause a lot of times between like being disappointed and getting angry. I mean, that's a big trigger for me in a personal relationship. And, you know, it goes back a lot to my, you know, pain and trauma of being disappointed early in my life and nobody being there. And in my experience, my mom not being responsive in the way I would have hoped that she would have reacted to, like when she told me my dad died, right? That was a terrible disappointment. And her walking out of the room at that time was just devastating, on top of the devastation I was already feeling. So now when I get disappointed in my relationship, my first thing is to get mad about it, because I'm still that little boy that's angry as shit about what's going on and all of the stuff that goes on inside. And now today I can catch that a lot sooner and go back and say, God, you know, I'm sorry I got so upset about what I'm really trying to say is how disappointed I am. Now, hopefully someday I can get rid of the anger step, right?
You don't have to get rid of it. It's like, very often our reflexes just stay the same. If I'm sitting in a room with a woman and they sigh, I still jump, you know, because sighing women scare me. And it's like, that's my reflex. It's like, I also have that, you know, you and I have talked about that secondary response. It's like, you know, that secondary response comes in and just reminds me, and it's quite habitual now, where I just go like, no, that's just a woman breathing, you know, but it's like, by you knowing that you have that reaction, you can take disappointment and turn it into anger, you're so much more likely to catch it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I can get there. But, you know, I'm also, and you see, this is one of the things that I know I'm unreasonable in this, but, you know.
Well, we all know that about you, Alan. We don't need to go over that again.
Of course I can be outrageous. You know, one of my outrageous things is to want a relationship that there can be room for me to get angry. I mean, I remember maybe this is unreasonable, but I think it is. I say maybe because I'm not sure it is. And I'm really not. You know, I struggle with this because Kempler was very clear when I trained with him of saying, look, let's let go of all the rules on how we need to talk to each other. And instead of worrying about how we're talking to each other, let's encourage people to keep yelling and shouting until they find out what they're really shouting about. See, that's the context I'd like to be in, where I'm with someone that can say, fucking keep screaming for a while until you find out what's right underneath that, until you get down to your disappointment or your pain, because that's what's always underneath my anger is disappointment, hurt, that kind of a thing. But I get angry to protect myself at first, right? Now, that's a lot to ask for someone, right? I mean, you can imagine that, you know, I can be a pretty powerful fucking guy at times, and my anger could be scary. I'm sure. I mean,
that's one of those things where it's subjective. I mean, that's, I know some people that's a beautiful way to approach it, and other people that it absolutely will be destructive. So it's like, that's part of using our good judgment about ourselves and other people.
Yeah, other people. You're right about that, Tom, is that it's not a rule that goes out all the way.
I like the idea of not being stuck in the, you know, just the polite rules.
That's where Walter was coming from. It's let's let go of these ideas and let's encourage each other to find the right words to your experience. And if you have to yell before you get there, you yell. If you have to cry before you need to get to yelling, then cry first. I mean, it's not so much about yelling or not yelling or crying or not crying. It's about what are the words that really reflect what really is going on for us? And oftentimes when I can say that, I can be much more reasonable. If I can get down to, I am disappointed right now, I'd really like it to be this way. And I can think about, like we talk about, my mutual responsibility. What can I do in this situation to create what I want instead of just getting mad about not getting it?
Just going to say, I wonder if in that situation you would have to yell at the other person, or if you could just go in the other room and yell. And actually, for me, this is something my therapist suggested that I do when I get upset, and it sounds nutty, but just go in the other room and let it all out, like everything that I'm thinking and feeling and afraid to say, and just see where it takes me. And that helps me see the story that I'm telling myself about what's happening. And that can be very valuable.
For me, Dee Dee and I dealt with volume, you know, in couples therapy quite a bit because of her trauma. It's like the truth is, you know, she would say, he's yelling at me. And I would say, no, I'm being emphatic. and I actually meant that. It's like, you know, but.
That's hilarious, by the way.
I remember Mary Elizabeth, we had the perfect couple therapist that I helped change my life and made me a better human being. And I was mad at her constantly. And, you know, and I remember saying, I'm not yelling. And she said, yeah, you are. And I said, well, how do you know? She said, because Dee Dee just told me you were, you know, and we're talking about it. And the main point was, it goes back to the usefulness. It's like what she taught me was, the more imposing I became, the farther away Dee Dee reflexively retreated. And so, you know, I was, again, go back to useful. What I was doing was not useful to my purposes either. It's like, you know, and it turned out, I remember one time with Mary Elizabeth that said, what do you want me to do, sit on my hands? And she said, okay. Fuck. It was always win-win is what we were always looking for. It's like, she wasn't trying to deal me out of the thing. It was just, when you're working with a couple, it's like, we got two people we're trying to satisfy here.
Julia, you know, you were talking about your emotional sobriety ratio, you know, and you were saying you get it about 50% of the time.
I pulled that out of thin air, kind of, but yeah, I mean, definitely not all the time. Yeah, maybe even most of the time.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to dig into that a little bit because, I kind of think of emotional sobriety as like a North Star, and it's like we're going towards it, and there's no complete attainment ever, and we're always trying to, I'm always trying to get a better ratio, but I guess, you know, in terms of like your responses, you know, and you've used the example, you know, of your stepdaughter, as one. Has like, you know, some of these strategies, have they been coming into play, like in your responses and your handling of like these challenging relationships?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how far back I look, right? Like when I have a difficult day, you know, there are times when I'm like, am I doing this right? I still have a lot of self-doubt, you know, have I grown? And then, you know, one thing I've learned is look back 2 years, look back 5 years, look back 10 years. How did I respond? What were my relationships like? And like, I see it very clearly in my romantic relationship with my partner, right? I'm able to let go of things that are not that important, you know, like how we load the dishwasher is a thing, right? Where we're just like, right.
Things that literally don't matter. It's like, that's one of the most recent things that I've been talking to people about is just wrote it on one of my nutshells. It's just, most things don't matter. It's like, I mean, and people think, well, that sounds, you know, apathetic and stuff like that. Like, no, it's actually energy efficient. It's like, how many things do we get upset about in the course of a day that actually, you know, if we're on our deathbed, we're going to go back and go like, ah, man, Julia could not load that dishwasher right.
By the way, I'm the one who loads it like a, you know, like a drugged raccoon. There's a meme about that. Right. But in the very beginning, you know, we're both able to let things go. Like we notice in the moment when we're starting to escalate, And that awareness of like, I'm getting, and does this matter? Like, no. And, you know, both of us can catch ourselves and be like, you know what? Yeah. Like, admit that we're wrong. First of all, like, I couldn't do that in the beginning because admit I was wrong meant, I don't know what it meant.
It cost too much. It really, yeah, emotionally, it cost too much. But you use the term self-doubt. And one of the things I always want to help people clarify is self-doubt and self-condemnation are way different. And we always want to have self-doubt. It's like it's like the difference between skepticism and cynicism. We hear the word skeptic and we think, oh, cynic. It's like, no, we should all be skeptical, which just means we're curious. You know, self-doubt means we're curious and we're open to learning, because sometimes I have self-doubt. And then by the time I processed it through, I have self-certainty. I feel good about where I am, you know, and other times I go like, no, I got to let this one go, you know. You load the dishwasher.
And I have both, And the self-condemnation is really decreasing. The self-doubt, you know, I'm willing to be wrong.
There was a time in my life where just saying that sentence out loud, certainly where other people could hear me, would have hurt me so bad. It felt like I was doing self-inflicting harm, you know? It's like I'm willing to be wrong, but willing to be wrong. I mean, Roger talks about this a lot. Willing to be wrong is freedom. You know, it gives you, I can do whatever I want to do. I can say whatever I want to say, because I don't, as a matter of fact, and I think this is probably true for the four of us, it's not only has that changed in a little bit, it's changed so much that ideas, when I realize I'm able to acknowledge I'm wrong, I actually feel good about those times. I feel good about myself. I have my humility actually goes, knowing I have humility goes into my self-esteem. You know, I have on the wall in here, I have a nutshell that says, be careful not to be too proud of your humility.
See, I think that it's an interesting thing is that the things that we need and that we want become such a source for resentment in relationships. The need is not the issue, right? The issue becomes one more of, how do I deal with that? And now then it goes to, well, how were my needs dealt with early on in my life? Like, how did people respond to my need for togetherness? How did people respond for my need for separateness, you know, when I was growing up? Those things were not managed well. I think in most of our families, and I know in mine, it's really true, it wasn't. And that's going to show up in terms of our relationship. There's no question about it. And it comes back down to what you're saying. It's, how do we manage these things, right? How do we deal with these and respond? Well, look, this has been a great show. And let's have you back again. And And I know it's early for you. So thank you so much for getting out of bed and joining us today.
No, so grateful to be here. This was lovely. Thank you.
And when we have you back, I'd like to hear about your experience with yoga. You know, Alan's very body focused as well. He does tennis, he does boxing. You know, it helped. It's like water for the garden of emotional sobriety is, you know, getting moving. So for next time.
For next time.
Everybody keep your eye out for those Inuksuks.